President Erdogan have been super careful about making comments about NATO, right? He isn't that careful about making comments about other European countries or other institutions, even UN Security Council, because NATO matters for Turkey. Yeah, but obviously what happens in Turkey never stays in Turkey, right? The direction of Ankara or its policies have huge implications for NATO, for US, and for regional countries.
Hey, welcome back to the Modern War Institute podcast. I'm John Amble, editorial director at MWI, and for this episode, I had the chance to speak with Dr. Ziya Mural. He is a senior associate fellow at the Royal United Services Institute and a visiting fellow at the Royal Navy's Strategic Studies Center. And among a range of areas of expertise and research focus, he specializes in Turkish foreign policy, which makes him the perfect guest for this episode's discussion. Turkey is in the middle of an extraordinarily close presidential election, the closest challenge that Recep Tayyip Erdogan has faced in his 20 years in power. The election offers an opportunity to take a broad look at the development of Turkish foreign policy, strategy, and statecraft over the past two decades, and to look forward. From a grand strategy perspective, what are Turkey's fundamental objectives? How does it perceive its position in an increasingly multipolar world? And what are the keys to maintaining the vital relationship between Turkey and NATO, of which it has been a member for more than 70 years? The discussion explores these questions and more, but before we get to it, a couple quick notes. First, if you're not yet subscribed to the MWI podcast, you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. And second, as always, what you hear in this episode are the views of the participants and don't represent those of West Point, the Army, or any other agency of the U.S. government. All right, here's my conversation with Dr. Ziya Mural. Ziya, welcome to the MWI podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So as listeners will have heard in the intro, I asked you to come on the podcast today to talk about the recent presidential election in Turkey. In fact, the ongoing presidential election, since neither candidate hit a 50% majority, and it is heading to a runoff. I should note at the outset, we're recording this a few days after the election, and probably 10 or 12 days before the runoff. I'd really like to sort of, you know, I want to discuss the election because it is interesting and it is significant, but more broadly, I'd really like to kind of use it as an opportunity and a sort of jumping off point to explore, you know, first, whether the outcome might lead to any sort of change in say Turkish foreign policy, but more generally to kind of talk about the evolution of Turkish foreign policy over the last 20 years, the period when Erdogan, the current president, has been in power, as well as sort of, you know, Turkish strategic culture and you know, Turkey as a state actor in what are you know, really unique geographic and geostrategic conditions surrounding it. So to begin, anybody paying attention to the news in recent weeks sees that, you know, has seen that global media outlets are certainly paying attention to this election, perhaps more so than in quite a while. Can you give listeners a sense of how significant the election is and why?
Yeah, but obviously what happens in Turkey never stays in Turkey, right? So because of the geographic position, the kind of really complex linking of so many security, defense questions, geopolitical questions, the direction of Ankara or its policies have huge implications for NATO, for US, and for regional countries, whether it is about Syria, it is Black Sea, or even Ukraine, or stability in East Med with Cyprus, tensions between Greece and Turkey, questions around irregular migration, narcotics, organized crime, arms control, question about Russia and even Iran. So any policy you develop on Iran, sanctions and etc., you need to consider what you will see from the government in Ankara towards Iran and even in Israel and Armenia and Karabakh. So in other words, in a lot of these key areas of importance for NATO, for US, for Europe, you can't imagine not including an analysis of Turkey. And if you do, you will fail because, yes, it might not be the most powerful actor in the middle of all of these, but it is a sizable regional power, and it is a NATO member. No matter how sometimes it can get tricky for some members to push every policy that they have to, but what happens in Turkey matters because it's a lot bigger than itself in terms of its footprint and its influence and implications.
I think most listeners, they'll be at least, you know, relatively familiar with Erdogan. He's been a fixture in power in Turkey for 20 years, first as prime minister and now as president. But I wonder, you know, if possible, if you can briefly kind of compare and contrast the two candidates in terms of maybe, you know, their view of Turkey in the world as a state actor, as a NATO member.
Yeah, so it's interesting because obviously, particularly in the domestic and political sphere, both candidates are very different in their personalities. Erdogan is a much more stronger, assertive leader, and Kılıçdaroğlu is much more accommodating and gentler and inclusive, kind of both in as a policy, but also as a personality as well too. One of them is pretty much taking Turkey to a single party, strong state direction where all the power is held at the executive level with the president, but way more powerful than the president of the United States because there is no US Congress or Senate to basically keep him accountable or decide on the budget or give authorization on certain policies. So presidential office in Turkey is much more powerful than what it is in the United States. So the personality, the outlook of the individual who assumes that office will matter. But when it comes to foreign policy, it's a bit tricky because even though Erdogan, being a religious nationalist, have certain sensitivities, which he changed. I mean, at one stage, he really didn't want to be engaged with Islamist movements in the Middle East at all. He wasn't interested in Central Asia or China. He was trying to take Turkey into EU, saw Cyprus emerge as this kind of religiously conservative but kind of liberal market economy, independent country that doesn't have at least frictions with any of its neighbors and can be influential internationally. And increasingly, he went through a much more assertive, particularly in Arab Spring onwards, to a policy of supporting particular Sunni political movements in the Middle East and not really shying away from increasingly asserting Turkish positions through military means, sending boats or opening up forward operating bases, investing into Turkish intelligence, military capabilities. So you have seen how over the years he evolved from one vision of Turkey as let's engage with Europe, with US, normalize all the tensions, attract investment, be pro-European integration, but also maintain our identity and values. From that increasingly to a vision where he sees Turkey as a regional power that needs to maintain strategic independence, and it cannot allow external powers or regional powers to take decisions on Syria, on gas findings in Cyprus or developments in Black Sea, the boundaries of Greece, Turkey, kind of maritime borders and economic zones, without them being heard and actually accepted as a party. So it doesn't want to accept the fait accompli anywhere on its borders. So you've seen an increasingly assertive and offensive Turkey, which perhaps is in line with the global times we live in. I mean, you see that all across the world, regional powers as well as the superpowers are asserting themselves in geopolitical terms for long-term interests. So I think he adopted into that. Kılıçdaroğlu is weaker in foreign policy terms. He speaks a lot about returning Syrians back to their country, which is obviously a huge thing for Turkish voters because they have around 5 million or more Syrian refugees in the country, which is causing increasing political friction. And it signals towards better views with even towards EU, towards US, and towards other actors. But in real life terms, a lot of the kind of current tensions that we have between Turkey and US, between Turkey and Europe, are not going to disappear under him because some of these are long-term strategic divergences, like between Turkey and US, and some of these are dead-end things like Turkish accession into EU. That's just not going to happen, no matter who is in government in Turkey. It's not just about Turkey. For that reason, I think if Kılıçdaroğlu wins, yes, you might see a more positive conciliatory message. But a lot of these key questions on how does Turkey handles Russia while also being a NATO member is not going to disappear because Kılıçdaroğlu himself said, you know, they do not want to jinx the relationship with Russia and actually they need to work with Russia as well as with US, as well as with NATO. And that highlights that not everything actually is about Erdogan or his maybe a type of Islamism he pursues. This is because of the geographic necessities that sometimes governments in Ankara will see the world differently than we do in the West, in London or in DC.
I'm glad you brought up Russia because, you know, we have a tendency sometimes, I think, and it's very natural, I suppose, to do this, but we sort of simplify things down to these, you know, these binary constructs of East and West, Moscow and Washington or Moscow and Brussels, you know, or Beijing and Washington in certain circumstances. We seem to sort of maybe want to quantify, you know, the degree to which any particular state or regime is pro-Western or pro-Russian. But it's not this one-dimensional spectrum, right? Statecraft is much more complex and much more multidimensional than that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I wonder if we can kind of drill down a little bit on that specifically, you know, how the current tensions between Russia and the U.S., Russia and much of Europe over the war in Ukraine, how those tensions look from Ankara.
Yeah, no, I think it's a really important point you made, John, because, yes, I mean, I think there's always a tendency to kind of see those regional powers or partner states as just simply waiting there to go with every policy that we come up with in London or D.C. or Brussels or Paris or, you know, wherever, in Berlin and etc. But they also have to uphold their own national interests. They also have to balance their domestic politics, and they also have to assess the economic implications and security implications. So sometimes I've always been very kind of sarcastic about people writing op-eds about, is Turkey turning away from the West? For example, when Turkey stepped in Libya to kind of back the UN-engaged, even U.S., approved government in Libya, it was the French actually that were engaging with Wagner and Russia-backed, General Haftar on the east. But all of the media commentary was talking about, is Turkey turning away from the West? What are they doing in Libya? Not whether France is turning away from the West, or when Germany's policy towards Russia is actually could be as more difficult, has been more problematic in some ways than Turkey in certain critical conjunctures. We didn't necessarily discuss whether Germany is turning away from the West, or Austria, or even at some stages, United States. I mean, during the Trump administration, there were moments where on this side of the ocean, we genuinely wondered whether U.S. is turning away from the West, the ideals of it, as well as its foreign policy. So I think within an alliance called NATO, we always have to accept the fact that there are going to be divergences for the very local factors these countries find themselves in. In Turkish terms, Turkey needs Russia for its interest in Syria, right? So Turkey cannot influence or operate or partake in conversations on Syria without engaging with Russia, right? Just because Russia made itself as an important player there, which is a discussion we need to have. Why did we allow Russia such a space in Syria? That's another podcast. But Turkey needs Russia for energy. You know, Turkey needs Russia for tourism and industry and selling of things and buying of things, vice versa. And because it's literally there, and then Turkey wants stability in the Black Sea. Turkey doesn't want to see tensions and but at the same time, Turkey is also vulnerable to Russia. I mean, Russian misinformation and disinformation games, the counterintelligence threat that it poses to Turkey, even killing of opposition figures, you know, by Russian related groups in Turkey. And again, all these divergences on Ukraine and Syria. Turkey has been on the opposite ends of the views on Ukraine, on Syria, against Russia, while also having to maintain that working relationship with Putin. They were fighting against Putin in Syria, and they were providing drones to Ukraine and banning Russian vessels coming from Crimea to go through. And they did close down the straits in a particular kind of way too, because of the treaty that regulates the straits for Black Sea, etc. So you're realizing a nation that actually we have to have a bit more of a sympathetic ear given to them to say they have to balance these interests. Yes, sometimes the polemics, the attitude isn't helpful, but there are very tangible concerns here. Like in Syria, for example, you know, when the coalition decided to arm a group related to a group that is organically part of a group that is fighting against Turkey for the last 40 years, of course they were not going to be happy about it. This isn't about whether Turkey is giving up on the West and choosing East. This is about their own national security and their own interests and long-term stability. So some of these kind of moments of crisis, I often feel, by all means, let's find a diplomatic breakthrough and a solution, because NATO matters, this alliance matters. And if you were NATO-focused for the last 10, 20 years, even before the latest Russian invasion of Ukraine, even since 2014, and I've been saying this to everybody who listened, you cannot imagine a NATO response to Russia and to the Russian risks without actually still keeping Turkey within the umbrella. You will damage the alliance's interest so much if Turkey is not within this umbrella, no matter how tricky it can get. So we need to find a way to work through them. With this empathic attitude, we should be able to contain the divergences and hopefully find tangible things to improve the current kind of broken down trust.
What explains that? You know, there are disagreements between NATO member states all the time, really. For, you know, for a long time, Germany took a very different position than the United States on Nord Stream 2, for instance. France obviously was not at all happy about the AUKUS submarine deal. But we seem to usually be able to sort of firewall those disagreements, treat them as individual things that don't threaten the fabric of the NATO alliance. But, you know, when, for instance, you know, when Turkey says it wants to buy Russian S-400 air defense systems, you know, there seems to be a lot of hand-wringing about whether or not, you know, Turkey is a reliable ally. What explains that?
I think some of it is legitimate concern, right? If you have a NATO ally within the middle of this kind of context of all this geopolitical development says, I'm going to buy S-400s. Initially, I think it emerged as their genuine need for off-the-shelf air defense system after the coup attempt, which nobody was providing at that stage. And also it increasingly became a tool, I think they saw as a bargaining chip or a diplomatic kind of gesture with Russia vis-a-vis Syria and balancing the tensions they found themselves with US particularly and Europe. Because of their own grievances towards them. So some of it is because of that. These are real issues, and I think it's a legitimate question. Why are you buying this missile system? Some of that is because of diplomatic polemics and languages you've seen coming from Ankara, and some of them is incidences like Turkish bodyguards beating protesters in D.C. outside of the, you know, the Turkish embassy, and a whole series of diplomatic kind of failures on both counts to basically say, look, you know, professionalize, keep it, not personalized. And some of that is definitely Ankara's fault. Some of that is, you know, the fault of other capitals and other, some of that is religious, some of that is ideological, right? So I think for some people in Europe and US, Turks are always the odd one out because it's a Muslim majority nation within the alliance. And when you had all these questions around extremism and terrorism, and then all of a sudden you don't understand the complexities of the Middle East or how these things pan out, then there's, I think, a lot of unspoken stress. That's why I think a lot of debates about northern Syria and what, how should U.S. approach, fight there, and how do you handle Kurdish militants? There was a lot of that unspoken that actually, yes, I think Erdogan's later part of Arab Spring involvement with some of these Muslim Brotherhood groups and backing some of these groups, I think did make people feel a bit uneasy about whether this is going to be some sort of a Islamist Turkish foreign policy undermining all these efforts in the region, which turned out not to be the case. So I think it's a complex picture, but you can dissect it in different ways and see, you know, this is probably a failure mixture of both how Ankara communicates in a very domestic polemical way to abroad, which they shouldn't, and how they've been unwise about how they undertake some of the policies, but also how we sometimes dismiss their very legitimate concerns about what happens when you arm the same Kurdish militants they've been fighting for 40 years. You're not going to have a sustainable policy if that's the start point of it. And of course, that's going to cause friction because obviously that's what US wants to do. But on the ground, they won't let it continue beyond your initial achievement of it.
You mentioned that NATO benefits from having Turkey inside the tent. You know, there were sound strategic reasons for Turkey's accession to the alliance in 1952, and those reasons endured throughout the Cold War. You know, but I wonder if sort of as a thought experiment, we imagine that Turkey had not previously been a member of NATO, and we put ourselves in 2004 when the alliance underwent its largest expansion. Would NATO and Turkey at that point have looked at each other and said, "Yeah, this is a good fit"? You know, I should caveat that and say that, you know, by no means is that to suggest that Turkey shouldn't be a member today. I actually absolutely, you know, I agree with you. NATO is stronger with Turkey in the alliance for a whole host of reasons. Yeah. But I guess my question is, you know, countries shift in their thinking about the strategic wisdom of joining an alliance like NATO or choosing non-alignment. We saw that most recently in Finland and Sweden, of course, last year. In a strategic environment today that is different than that of 1952 when Turkey joined, would, you know, I guess, would the sort of mutual interest in Turkey's membership have been similar?
Yeah. Do you know, it's obviously difficult to imagine, you know, what if historically things played out differently. But even today, I mean, if you say, look, Russia is the number one threat for NATO, particularly for those countries in the north and the east, and because of the very geographic realities, it's a really good goal for NATO to have Turkey in the alliance, no matter how demanding it can get, than it would have been if they were closer to Russia or much more kind of free in the way that they went about it. But if then for southern countries and others, if the question is irregular migration or counterterrorism, then actually there is one route which all of these things have, by geographic realities, have to go through or aim to go through, and that's Turkey. Again, you have to find a way to basically work on these issues together. So wishing a difficult ally away isn't a policy proposal, because then otherwise a lot of Europeans or even Americans would have wished France to be not in it, or Germany not in it, because their policies could also come across to the rest of the alliance as really not helpful. You know, the views in Poland, for example, about US presence in Europe for a long time has been quite positive and etc. And then other NATO countries didn't, in the north and in the west and southern Europe and etc. So I think it's very difficult to kind of imagine if NATO was created today, maybe it might be about China, right? So not necessarily Russia, because then it will be a really interesting thing if US and China finds themselves in a further crisis or escalation, how well the NATO alliance hold as an alliance within a crisis like that. That's quite a tricky question to answer. So that's why I think having NATO for what it is and strengthening it, and we've seen its value in Ukraine. For example, a few months before the invasion of Ukraine in 2022, President Macron was saying NATO is obsolete, you know, brain dead. And then, well, now he's a big champion of it, because it turns out NATO is really needed. And actually, it's adopted a lot since 2014. It learned a lot. So from how to respond to hybrid threats, to disinformation, misinformation, and how to basically bring the alliance together, NATO did rather well in 2022 and 2023. So I'm glad that President Macron doesn't repeat that line anymore. But coalitions of the willing within an alliance is perhaps what we need to think, particularly in an era of where you have a new geopolitical climate, where you have two world superpowers that are clearly seeing each other as an increasing kind of challenger, seismic threat to their kind of national interests and positioning. And you got all these medium regional powers are also saying this is the century or the decade of asserting yourselves, otherwise you won't get be heard, otherwise you won't achieve your interests. Then you're creating a multipolar bazaar of countries seeking multiple deals with each other. Then actually, then if you have to adopt into that, maybe a single multilateral organization or a structure led by or underwritten by a superpower to kind of agree on a particular policy to deliver it, maybe it's not possible beyond particular portfolios. So maybe this is not about Turkey, but this is about the very way we assumed what underwrites those kind of alliances and relationships and the security defense challenges. I think for the future, for the next 10 years, what we are more likely to see is NATO being protected and invested, and eventually it will cool off in some ways in terms of support and attention given to it, but other alliances and partnerships spinning off with clear portfolios, like France did with the European Intervention Initiative, and UK supported them in their operations in Mali. And US does with you, for example, with Britain in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I think those type of closer relationships won't disappear, and those regional powers and medium powers will always find ways to form new cliques. And that's actually good for the United States, right? So if you think about that, I mean, US doesn't necessarily want to be the world underwriter of every alliance that carries all these regional, medium and smaller powers. You know, the US wants those powers also pay the bill and own their own defense and do their own bit. So maybe actually looking at it that way gives both the US diplomacy and military planning a better playing field, because in a multilateral organization with a clear power structure, the way to politically influence it could get overwhelming or difficult. But if it's a bazaar of bargaining and multiple actors, we could perhaps get more, a better deal, or we could perhaps find different cliques and achieve differently. And that demands a different mindset. So it's no more a question of East versus West, but particular portfolios that we think this country or that country has a commitment, a share, and how can we influence them, and how can we work together or get them out of the picture in a way that doesn't affect our interest. And that's exciting, right? If I was a diplomat, I would say, you know, thank you. It's more exciting than Netflix series, right? In real life diplomacy, it's now more tricky than, you know, all the drama that we're watching at the moment.
I want to ask about Turkish strategic culture. And I recognize that that's sort of a vague term with amorphous meaning, but in this sense, I mean specifically sort of Turkey's self-perceived identity as a state actor on the world stage. You know, there's polling in NATO members done quite frequently that measures public sentiment toward the alliance, and it varies pretty widely. The Baltics, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, I think are probably a few examples where public support has been consistently high, but there are certainly examples where the public is, you know, somewhat more ambivalent. In Turkey, both, you know, among the public, but specifically among the policymaking elites, so to speak, how does NATO membership factor into, you know, that sort of strategic culture? Is it a centerpiece of it, or is it more of a peripheral issue?
Well, it's interesting because actually, in terms of professional military foreign policy and state level of conversation, even President Erdogan had been super careful about making comments about NATO, right? He isn't that careful about making comments about other European countries or other institutions, even UN Security Council, because NATO matters for Turkey, right? Turkey sees NATO as both as an asset for itself, for its own defense vis-a-vis Russia, and also an opportunity for its military to learn, to adopt, have access to technologies and information and know-how in operations and exercises, and also a tool for its influence if it's such a mighty alliance on its borders, it wants to be in it rather than outside of it. And that's quite ingrained. Politically, within Turkish politics, you always have Turkish left, Turkish right, Turkish Islamists, even liberals that are not really pro-US at all. I mean, US has unfavorability ratings higher than 80% or so. And if Pew Global Attitude Survey often show Turkey as one of the most anti-American countries in the world, which is also fascinating because till the recent Syria divergence, there wasn't any direct kind of fallout between Turkey and US for decades. But it was quite part and parcel of the culture. I mean, the voters don't necessarily like the fact that Turkey is in military alliances, but NATO still gets around 40 to 50% of favorability, which is quite high compared to even other NATO states. Now, the Russian invasion of Ukraine changed a lot in Europe, but 2 years ago, populations in Europe would also have been very oblivious or cynical towards NATO. So I think at the professional level, NATO is seen as an important asset not to be shaken. NATO has, I think, more than $10 billion worth of investments within Turkey in terms of military bases and radar systems and obviously strategic weapons and things like that. So and capabilities, and obviously NATO land commander is based in Izmir, Turkey, and those things matter for Turkey as well as for NATO, and they really don't want to shake that. But at the same time, I think what we need to understand is Turkey does see itself as a strategically, a country that wants to be strategically independent, a country that also wants to protect its own interests, and it's got its own red lines. And I think not just for Erdogan, for the vast majority of those in Ankara, in security, military, foreign policy establishment, they weren't happy and they will not be happy by seeing a Kurdish state-led, led by a PKK-related group in North Syria. So in 1999, Turkish tanks were about to invade Syria for the same reason that actually they fell out with U.S. involvement with YPG in North Syria, because that's been a long-term kind of internalized risk perception for whoever is in Ankara. So you see those kind of fault lines, which no matter who's in government, it is there, it matters to them. But I think the use of drones, for example, and the new investment into national defense industries is a big shift in that strategic culture too, because while all Turkish governments in the 70s, particularly with the Cyprus crisis, have talked about importance of nationalizing defense because Turkey was under blockade again with US, with others not providing weapons because of the invasion of Cyprus, intervention there, and etc. So since then, they have been talking a lot about how do we invest in our own national defense, because we don't want to go to US. If you remember, Turkey was trying to buy drones from Israel 2 decades ago or so, and when the relations fell off, Israeli drone operators and trainers just left. So all of a sudden, you got this like, well, this is what we needed, but actually, we need to have our own capabilities. So that is altering not only Turkish capabilities but also strategic culture, because now, for the last 6-7 years especially, Turkey is adopted into forward deployments of operations, whether it's special forces or intelligence agency with drones, as well as militias on the ground, as well as its own kind of operations. That wasn't there before, a decade ago. And that's altering kind of the policymakers' risk appetite as well as toolkit, right? So they're not just looking at, you know, doing diplomatic engagement with Europe or US and getting agreement, but they're also saying, well, we have our own capabilities. I don't need US's approval to fly my drones or sell my drones. And I'm building in this type of naval vessels and this type of new rockets and armored vehicles, and I will sell them too. So that is, I think, already altering their strategic perspectives, because now there's a new era for Turkey where they are able to operate abroad. Like even some of their responses in Syria, when Syrian forces with supposed Russian support killed Turkish soldiers a couple of years ago, the operation they pulled with joint fires and how they were able to retaliate and take down a lot of Syrian assets and mercenaries was actually impressive militarily. It did, to me, highlight that they now have those capabilities, know-how, and a desire to use them when necessary, which automatically changes your strategic culture. And I think that's new. But I'm always wary of people reading kind of Turkish strategic culture or policymakers as vocabularies of neo-Ottomans or East versus West. Those are really futile tricks that work in opinion editorials or tweets, but doesn't really help us at all within the alliance to say, okay, look, what are their capabilities? How do they see these crises and their interests and how they might respond and what they might do as a response? None of these vocabularies help us to decode that analytically.
That's really interesting. You know, we've seen Turkey emerge as a sort of force in terms of its defense industry. Probably the most recognizable example of that recently is Baykar, the manufacturer of, among other things, the TB2 Bayraktar drone, exports of which played a major role in the 2020 Nagorno-Karabakh war, and definitely played a role in the Ukraine war, especially early in the conflict. But it's really fascinating to me that you paired that with examples of this, you know, kind of emerging expeditionary military and intelligence capability, and together these two things are kind of signs of a Turkey that that is maybe becoming more comfortable, as you said, being a player and doing what successful states do, seeking to advance its interests abroad. If we sort of turn back to the presidential election, is that a trend that is likely to continue regardless of who wins, or is it perhaps going to be either accelerated or slowed down based on who is president?
So, I mean, that would depend on who is in the opposite seat, right? So Kılıçdaroğlu and his alliance, looking at the statements that he's made, he's not comfortable with foreign policy. He doesn't really have a clear kind of thought-through strategic framework to even put a language to it, besides at this stage kind of pushing on the electoral things like sending Syrians back home or engaging with Europe again and etc. So those are all good and well, balancing with Russia. So these are all electoral messages, not necessarily that, but some of the comments he also made about the defense industry and etc. So at the back of my mind, I think Kılıçdaroğlu himself represent the old school Turkish foreign policy impulse, which was more quieter isolationist. In other words, yes, you remain in NATO, don't get involved with the Middle East. I mean, Kılıçdaroğlu continually uses this disturbing phrase of swamp of the Middle East. He's going to pull Turkey out of the swamp of the Middle East. I find it very disturbing as a perception of the Middle East, and also as a foreign policy language, whatever underwrites that. So in that case, he might not really necessarily have a strong vision to push forward for a proactive Turkey as Erdogan has, or an assertive Turkey. But do not underestimate how any of these issues, is it Cyprus, is it energy question with Greece, or is it Greece declaring an extension of to 12 miles of their kind of economic zones or the small islands in the agency, or is it developments with PKK-related groups in Syria? I don't think even Kılıçdaroğlu government would react differently. In fact, his alliance includes a lot of nationalists, and they would have the same impulse as Erdogan, which is, you can't let these groups to form a country in North Syria. You can't let Cyprus to do that, or you can't just let Greece declare all of the Aegean and lock us down to pretty much 100 meters beyond our shoreline into the Aegean. So I don't think that is actually going to disappear at all. But at the same time, I think you might see a Turkey that is less willing to operate in places like maybe Libya or take a more bold lines. Even in Syria, he's been talking about pulling the personnel back there in Iraq. But in real life terms, he might not be able to do that operations in Iraq have been going on for 30 years or so by Turkish military, you know, so, and because of, again, the PKK question. So I think he might find himself stuck with a lot of complex foreign policy portfolios, but maybe perhaps don't pick polemics. But at the same time, if he talks about sending Syrians back home, everybody in Europe listens to that as, oh my goodness, there's going to be another wave of irregular migration coming into Europe, because those, not all the Syrians would want to go back to Syria. They will try to make a way to Europe, and that would give a heart attack for European politics all across, and that would put a huge pressure on Kılıçdaroğlu to find a solution not to allow those Syrians come to Europe. But where do you send them? You know, what do you do then? Which then he doesn't have an answer to. So I think he might find himself actually quickly, facing a quite uphill struggle with Europeans on some of these kind of campaign promises that he made. But if Erdogan retains power, for the last 12 months or a year or two, he's been easing the message. He's been trying to, he kind of normalized with Saudi Arabia a bit, with UAE, even with Egypt, and even with US, there's a lot more calm at the moment. He will probably continue that for a while because he needs the investment. He needs to ease up some of these tensions. But again, looking at last 20 years, I don't think you can expect Erdogan to change anymore substantially. So I think, you know, this is going to boil down to, yes, occasional easing because of the needs and crises, but occasional crises that could actually really break down relations. So all duty care needs to be given, basically, so that we make sure these things are not broken irreplaceably. And again, that's pretty much where we are now. So I think if Erdogan wins, we will just go back to where things were a week ago, rather than something brand new.
So I had sort of intended to wrap up with a couple of final questions about the election, circling back to where we started. But I actually want to take a slight detour because of something you said. The campaign promised to, you know, that you mentioned, to pull Turkey out of the swamp of the Middle East. You know, to me, if you withdraw from the Middle East, you know, I guess, does that imply a perception that Turkey is not the Middle East? Since, you know, you can't really leave a place if it's where you live. And, you know, I understand that geographic labels can be tricky, and often they're, you know, specific designations can be contentious, of course, but, you know, they're also characterized by sort of different interpretations. You know, I think of, you know, when Americans go on vacation to Europe, and if you ask them where, they might say, oh, you know, London, Paris, and Amsterdam, and they don't differentiate. All three are equally Europe in that context and from that perspective. But when I lived in London, people would say, you know, they're going to Europe, and that means the continent. And that's not just the, you know, political idea of Europe and, you know, post-Brexit. It's a common geographic understanding of Europe as being on the other side of the English Channel. These, you know, and again, they're pretty common geographic labels, but they can mean very different things. So, you know, for Turkey, it sits in this really complex physical space where, you know, even a single city, Istanbul, is split by the Bosphorus, and there's a European side of the city, or what we call the European side of the city, and what we call the Asian side of the city. I think, you know, it's also, Turkey is fairly widely, but maybe not unanimously, considered part of the Middle East. But there are a number of features, ethnic, linguistic, what have you, that sort of set it apart from many other countries in the Middle East, in that region. So in that respect, and you know, I know that it's a gross oversimplification to suggest that there's a sort of single homogenous consciousness that all Turkish people share. But if I forgive that oversimplification, how does Turkey perceive itself?
You know, it's, I think one of the key challenges, John, is that Turkey is a post-imperial country, right? So I think people underestimate, like for Britain as well. So obviously as a British Turk, I have two empires to deal with, right? And their legacies, how they kind of shape the way that I see the world. But there are a lot of similarities, right? So a nostalgia towards the good old days in some circles, or in some circles, a sense that we really deteriorated so much. We have nothing to offer. Look at us. We're just a faint kind of power. Or the other way around. You know, the world is awaiting us, right? And to deliver, and our empire had also good things. I mean, Turks and Brits have that kind of empire legacy to process when they engage with those regions. And it was the same for Turks, like Davutoğlu and a lot of other previous foreign policy influences within AKP thought, well, you know, Africa and Middle East is just waiting for Turks to come back, right? You know, to again engage. And it turned out, well, not really. I mean, who's in the Middle East, actually, when you break it down, that wants to be in an alliance with Turkey the way Turks and Azerbaijanis are, right? Because there's similarity of language towards Central Asia. So ethnically, linguistically, Turkish link isn't with Arabs or with Persians. It's with the Turkic republics or, you know, and countries in Central Asia all the way to West China. So for a lot of Turkish nationalists, when they talk about turning east, they've been looking east that way, not down south towards Arab countries. So and linguistically, it's different, right? Turks, yes, conservative religious Muslims know a Quranic Arabic and prayers and that is practical Arabic, not necessarily. I mean, you know, Turkish foreign ministry had awfully limited number of 2-3 people who could speak Arabic when AKP came into power, right? So it's increased definitely, but they also have been away from that region, not engaging with it. Some of that is, again, because of historical legacy, the wars, the tensions, the legacies of the Ottoman Empire, and etc. Some of that is linguistic. I mean, and again, Turks, when you look at the West, who is closest to them in Europe? You know, you could say, you know, between those countries in Europe, there are linguistic similarities in cultural, religion, food. Well, Turks are more East Med, so they have more common with Greece, perhaps, than the language and historical rivalries and tensions suggest. Perhaps they're closest to each other with Italians and Greeks, maybe Greeks especially, historically as well, too. But they are an East Med country. So I always say, look, you have to let Turkey to be a free-range Turkey in the sense that this is a country that will always have its own unique kind of parameter of identity, history, and it will always be Eastern Europe, East Med, Levant, Middle East, Europe, Black Sea, Central Asia blend, and that's because of what it is. So again, just like what you said, maybe the challenge that now we are facing is those languages and categories we've used for so long, like Europe, Middle East, very neat kind of boundaries, it becomes really difficult to maintain on the edges of all, and Turkey is the edge of all of those constructs.
Which also makes it a deeply fascinating place. So to kind of wrap up, I want to turn back once again to where we started with the presidential election. The runoff is on May 28th. And, you know, if I'm understanding you correctly, the way you described it is that there's perhaps some potential for a departure from the path that Turkey has been on as a, you know, as a state actor, but probably not a major one. And I'm wondering if that was, you know, was that sort of guaranteed? Was there any possibility of a candidate opposing Erdogan who would have taken the country in, you know, in a dramatically different direction? Because as we've seen, that happens in countries all over the world. It happens in the US, it happens in the UK, it happens, you know, again, it happens all over the world. A new leader enters office bringing a very, very different view of the country's role in the world than that of the predecessor in that office. There are major shifts in tone and tenor of sort of foreign policy. Was that, you know, I guess, was that a reasonable possibility in this particular election? And if not, does, you know, maybe does this election, which again is the closest challenge that Erdogan has had during his time in power, does, you know, does this election potentially kind of open the door for a larger change in the next election?
Yeah, look, I think Kılıçdaroğlu, or the current opposition candidate, was probably what was possible, right? His main focus is domestic. And his main foreign policy focus is, again, what domestic voters are worried about, which is the Syrian refugees and kind of broken down relations with Europe and the need for Turkey not to be entangled into wars in Syria or Iraq or Libya, as Erdogan, or take side in the Arab Spring or back Muslim Brotherhood and etc. In Egypt and so on and so forth. So I think what he's offering is that, not necessarily thought through a brand new kind of trajectory for Turkey, even though he spoke about, for example, starting a Turkic Silk Road, going all the way to China and to do trade and making it profitable for China, if only China also then stops persecuting Uyghur Muslims, which are related to Turks ethnically. And again, well, that's not new. I mean, I heard this for 30, 40 years in Turkish politics, in Central Asia trade, and even in China. I mean, China has been coming up with this Belt and Road Initiative in different names and different disguises for decades now. So that's actually not a new thing. And so I think that's at his weakest. But at the moment, obviously, the only way to topple Erdogan in his position in power is through the box, right? Is through elections. And elections are holding. I mean, the system works. Yes, it's not fair. In other words, Erdogan and his government and his party dominate the media and dominate all the state resources, and they have a huge political party organization. But look, opposition has done really well, actually, if you think about it, against all the odds. And it's not a fair election, but it's partially free. In other words, you can vote for whom you want, and your vote matters, and you can physically go there. But yes, some political figures, like in the Kurdish movement, are in prison. Yes, there's a kind of cultural fear and self-censorship. People don't feel the freedom like we would feel in US or in UK or in Europe to raise all the concerns they could raise or any kind of points they want to make. Yes, the media isn't fully free, so there is that question. But the elections are valuable, and Erdogan needs them. I mean, it's very telling that even after 20 years, even after all this kind of control and centralization of power, it's fundamentally important for him to win, and because that's the only way he can maintain it. Even his own voters won't let it. So that's, to me, gives me hope in the future. So this might very well be Erdogan's last term constitutionally, unless they change the constitution again, which is also very possible, to give him more time. And Turkey is a country full of surprises, like, and its population. And the fact that, John, we have more than 87% turnout rate in elections last Sunday, I mean, it says something about that country, you know, that actually people own their fate, people own their democracy or the way they want to be governed. And that kind of gives me hope that actually you're not looking at a police state or a strong state like Russia or even a dysfunctional voting power game like in Pakistan, where, you know, the former president keeps get arrested or running to exile and etc. You are looking at a dynamic yet troubled democracy that actually could turn around very differently. And I think the role of US, the role of Europe in influencing that conversation shouldn't be underestimated. And I think Europe punched under its weight on influencing Turkey for decades now, and it chose to for so many reasons. I think US tried in certain moments to do more and to do less, but it's also limited in what it can do. But I think there's a lot more that can be done to hopefully find a way to contain the risks ahead and think long term about a country that matters. I mean, Turkey is not a country you can just brush off as you do in a tweet or an opinion editorial. Reality hurts. It's there, and it is going to be there as a very strong regional actor we need to work and engage with.
Well, Ziya, I want to thank you again for joining me. I think we will leave it there. It's been a fascinating discussion, as it always is with you. This election really is. It's interesting. It's significant. But I also appreciate you kind of indulging me as we use it really as the basis for a much broader conversation, conversation that I really enjoyed. So thank you very much.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to the MWI podcast. One last thing. If you aren't yet following MWI on social media, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn. It is a great way to stay up to date on all of the new articles, podcast episodes, research, and more that we're publishing every day. Thanks again.